God made the world and all its wonders for man to explore. And there are countless wonders just outside your front door. Now join natural world photographer and journalist Roger W. Downs as he shares the stories of the people, places, music, and cuisines he has discovered as we explore with RWD.
Hey, welcome into another episode. This is episode 8, and we're going to highlight the history behind the DuPont State Forest in Western North Carolina. Now, if you've never been there, it's an amazing state forest with 8 different waterfalls, over 100 miles of trails, and several different lakes. But how it came about with the DuPont Company is really an interesting story all on its own. And local historian Danny Bernstein, who wrote the book DuPont Forest, A History, is going to join us coming up here in just a few minutes. But I really have to tell you the backstory of how I got to chatting with Danny in the first place. So it was a couple weeks ago that I went out to the DuPont State Forest because I wanted just to go chill out at Hooker Falls, which is about a 12-foot waterfall, but it's really wide in like the C formation. And it's one of my favorite waterfalls in Western North Carolina because there's just some sort of serenity there that I cannot explain in words that I find. And I'll go and sit on the rocks and just talk to God. And by the way, I want to give all the glory to God in this podcast. It's because of his blessings I'm able to conduct this podcast and tell you about these places and the history behind them. So thank you, Lord, for small favors. Amen. But I like to go talk to God there and just relax before all the tourists get in. So I'm usually there about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes I'll take the camera and take some photos, and sometimes I won't. But unfortunately, the Park Service there had closed off the trail that I was used to taking, which, by the way, I really loved because it went right along the little river and there were so many little cool places where you could go hang out on the rocks. But I understand things change, so they closed down that trail and opened up another one that went around the side of the ridges and down to the falls themselves. Now, I had never been on that trail previously because I'd always taken the one that ran along the little river because it was quicker and easier. Okay, I'm lazy. I'll admit it. But when you're hauling in 50 pounds worth of camera equipment, you're going to take quick and easy too. Trust me on that one. So I was taking that path, and that's where I discovered the Hooker Moore Cemetery. And there's a story of tragedy in that cemetery, actually several, which I found fascinating. So I started to call around and got a hold of the friends of the DuPont State Forest, who then put me in touch with Danny Bernstein, who's a local historian. And her book has so many great stories about the DuPont State Forest. You have to pick it up for yourself. You can find it on Amazon.com. Again, it's called DuPont Forest, A History. Or you can find a link to it right here in the description of this podcast, whichever you prefer. But we're going to talk with Danny next and discover how the DuPont State Forest came about in the first place. So stick around.
Don't wander off now. Explore with RWD will be right back after this.
Natural world photographer Benjamin Wall.
When I was in Alaska at one stage taking photographs of the grizzly bears on the Alaskan Peninsula, there was a bear that came out of the weeds. These really high grass, actually, just beside of me, and he was roaring and running right at me.
Be inspired by this story and others from Benjamin Walls in Episode 7 of Explore with RWD.
That wasn't too bad now, was it? Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
And welcome back in, and as promised, our guest today for Explore with RWD is Danny Bernstein, the author of DuPont Forest, A History. Danny, thank you for joining us. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This is exciting, Roger.
So let's talk a little bit about your book. What inspired you to take all that time to interview all those different people? It must have taken you, I can only assume, years of interviewing different families and experts to put all of that together, and that is quite the undertaking.
It is quite the undertaking. And this is not my first book, but this is my first book where I really focused on history a little bit more than hiking, because I think of myself as a hiker first. So why did I do this? Well, I moved here in 2001 he moved in to Asheville from New Jersey. And we were hikers. I joined Carolina Mountain Club. And of course, we went hiking in DuPont. And it wasn't so long after that that I learned that several of the CMC hikers and trail maintainers had worked at DuPont. They were DuPont Corporation retirees. And I started asking around, and how did this become a forest? And everybody had a different idea, depending on who you were talking to, how long they were here, etc. So several years ago, now remember, the DuPont, the company, and its heirs closed in 2002. That's a long time ago.
It has been a minute, yeah.
And I figured these folks were not getting any younger. And if anybody was going to take their story down, they better do it soon. So I started out with the people I knew who were CMC hikers, and one person referred me to somebody else who referred me to somebody else. But of course, I widened my lens beyond the employees to people who lived. I met a couple of people who were children who came to DuPont when it wasn't called DuPont, it was called Buck Forest Lodge, as children. And that was really exciting. I'd heard about that, but I never met people who remembered that clearly. And then I widened my lens to legislators and Brevard business owners. And of course, the Forest Service, the North Carolina Forest Service, anybody, any aspect of DuPont that I could find.
Now, I'm only about a fourth of the way through your book at this point, but I've found some stories in there that really grab my attention, like the Pilgrims that came up out of South Carolina, and people have to read your book to get that story. But what were some of your favorites after you did all your research?
Well, first of all, I only wrote about, quote, my favorite stories, because there was so much on the cutting floor. But I met a man, Earl Johnson, who was the oldest and the first engineer that came to DuPont, Le Brevard, from New Jersey, because that's where most of the engineers and scientists came from. And he's 95 years old. He lives in assisted living, and he's as sharp as a tack. And he told me a lot of stories and were able to answer a lot of questions, because most of the other people I met had come down in the 1970s, while this guy came down in 1957. He came before the plant actually opened, because he was a safety expert, and they needed those skills as part of building the plant.
Right.
And so he was certainly one of my favorite stories. And the other group that I really liked were the people I met who were children who came to DuPont, came to Buck Forest Lodge, because there was a lodge there. You could sort of think of it as a timeshare that a couple of people owned the land. Basically, the land was owned by two major landowners. There had been lots and lots of settlers over the years, well, basically since the American Revolution. But these two folks kind of consolidated the land, bought out these small family holdings. So by the time these children came along, and obviously they aren't children anymore, we're talking about before 1956, in the 1950s, one of the owners had built a hunting lodge called Buck Forest Lodge. And you can still see the remains. That's what I love about DuPont, is there's so much stuff that you can still see. And one of them is a chimney right in front of High Falls. And the chimney is the remains of Buck Forest Lodge. And families came, extended families with the friends, and were there for a week or two. And people hunted, fished, walked, the kids swam, and there was a lot of socialization, a lot of cocktail parties. But it ended up being, to me, a fascinating story.
And why is that?
Well, partly because of the age. It's as far back as I could go, because this lodge was built in 1941. It was built. In fact, if you go to the chimney now, you can see that the architect, the builder, had written the actual date in stone, in concrete, literally. And so that's why we know 1941. The other reason is there is very, very little written about DuPont, either before the company, during the company, and there's a lot more now that it became a forest.
Okay.
And so much of it I had to get from people.
And so that's why you wrote the book, of course, is because you wanted to share the history of the DuPont
forest.
So let's talk a little bit about DuPont, because I know people know the company, or at least they did. And so how did the forest get that name?
Well, the DuPont Corporation, which was even in those days, before 1950s, a multinational company, was looking to build a plant to manufacture silicon. This was the 1950s. Silicon chips was going to be a big, big market and for all sorts of things. But in those days, to manufacture silicon, they had to have the freshest water and the freshest air. And so they had real estate scouts go up and down the East Coast, because, you know, the DuPont Corporation is based in Wilmington, Delaware, though they're, again, multinational. And they hit upon what we now know as DuPont. And they made an offer, and they made an offer that the two main landowners took. Now, the first landowner, you would know his name if you're in the area, Frank Cox, COXE. And in Asheville, we have Cox Avenue and Short Cox. So the Cox family was very, very influential. Gosh, since before the revolution, when they emigrated and they owned a lot of land. And in my research, I got the impression that the DuPont holdings, they owned about 5,000 acres, was a minuscule part of their huge holdings throughout the centuries. And the second landowner was Alex Guyon. And you know Guyon because there's a entrance in the forest called Guyon Farms.
Mm-hmm.
And Guyon, Alex Guyon, did not have as established a pedigree. He actually bought the farm. And he was an engineer. And the thing you might know him the most is he was the general contractor for a hospital in the area. And when DuPont came along, they sold. And so DuPont started building a plant for silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And brought in a lot of the technical help from all over the country, mostly from New Jersey, because they had a small, tiny plant in New Jersey making silicon. Right. And they hired a lot of the locals for the assembly line. So it was a wonderful place to work in terms of not just salary, but benefits. And people talk about it being like a country club.
Oh, wow.
And in 1962, silicon was then becoming almost a commodity. And they wanted out of silicon. And they repurposed the whole site for medical films, medical x-ray film. And mammograms were starting to be popular. They started to be recommended. And so there was a huge market for x-ray film. So they repurposed, they built many more buildings, five actually, for various aspects of the of how film is made. And in the book, I talk about how film is made because I felt it was important to tell people what was actually going on there.
Right.
And, you know, I talked to a lot of engineers who set me straight until I got it right. And so DuPont had, they built a lake for their employees, and it was like a summer camp, and they had camping. You could hunt, you could fish, you could hike, obviously. And so it was really, I mean, I have stories of the, I also interviewed children of DuPont employees who aren't children, weren't children anymore. And they remember daddy dropping them off at the lake at 8:30 and picking them up at 5 o'clock during the summer. And they had a lifeguard. So it was a very good place to work.
I was going to say, that sounds like it was probably the dream job if you could have landed it.
Well, there was a big, competition to work at DuPont, but you got to remember in those days, there were other, places like that, like Acusta, for example, which was never as good a place to work, but it was kind of the same, paternalistic, let's keep the employees happy type of environment. So yes, it was a very good place to work, but all good things must come to an end. And they saw the writing on the wall that film was going digital. And so they sold the plant to another company that wasn't really going to stay there. And they just kept the plant running, and all of the all the benefits were exactly the same. And 3 years later, lo and behold, it was called Sterling Diagnostic. Lo and behold, they sold the plant to Agfa. Now, you've heard of Agfa Film.
Yep.
And Agfa kept it open for 2 years, then consolidated down in South Carolina, where they're still making x-ray film. And the plant closed November 2002.
That's sad.
Yes. And there's lots of other stories, so ask away.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I was reading through your book, and something that really fascinated me is getting back to the Buck Lodge thing.
Yes.
Is how the kids used to play along the river, because, and I'm talking about the river above High Falls.
Right. The Little River. It's called the Little River.
Yeah, the Little River there above High Falls, which would scare me as a parent. And I have children. I've taken my kids into DuPont, and I'm like, no, we don't play in the river above the falls. That's bad, bad idea. But those kids were fearless and had a pioneering spirit. Can you share what they were doing?
Well, as one of the guys told me, after breakfast, they wanted the kids out of there, out of the lodge. You know, it wasn't a huge place. So they want, you know, come back at dinner time. And the boys used to run around, because there were some trails, nothing like we have now, but there were some trails, because after all, people lived there. Mm-hmm. And then the kids, both boys and girls, used to swim not at the top of High Falls. Even then, it was considered dangerous. But if you go to High Falls now, and there is a trail, a very legal trail that takes you all the way down to the water, you can play there. In fact, you can do that now. Forest doesn't encourage it, but it's not illegal. So what the kids used to do was to go from the shoreline to the bottom of the falls and then climb up a little bit and slide down. Climb up a little bit more and slide down. But they never went to the very top and slid down.
Okay, I was going to say that would that would be interesting. I have seen people in kayaks go down triple falls, and I thought, you are all crazier than a pet raccoon.
I didn't realize people did that. Now, if you go like now, you cannot get that close to triple falls because people have been climbing up the falls, which is very dangerous.
Yeah, let's just take a moment here and remind people that waterfalls are dangerous to climb on because they're slick,
yes,
because they're covered in water. And since they're a waterfall, there is a fall included if you should lose your grip and fall.
And it is so easy to be photographing the falls at so many levels without endangering yourself.
Right, exactly.
So all, you know, there are six waterfalls in DuPont, which is in itself amazing that a place this small, now about 12,000 acres, has got six waterfalls, five lakes, and a bunch of other stuff.
It really has a ton of trails. What is it, 100 miles of trails, I think?
It's about 100 miles of trail of various kinds. By various kind, I mean hikers can use every trail. But bikes are limited. There are a few trails that bikes should not use, but it's very clear. But there's plenty of biking, of mountain biking. And I'm not a biker myself, but I have, as part of my book, I have talked to experienced mountain bikers, and they love it.
So what is the driving reason that makes them love it so much?
Well, it's, first of all, the Biking Association has helped in managing the trails. You know, so much of our public lands, whether it's federal or state, is maintained by volunteers.
Right.
And it's even truer when you involve bikes, because bikes may create more damage. And there's another constituency, which in DuPont is very important, and that is the equestrians. The horse people have been using the trails since way before it became public, because DuPont Corporation allowed people not connected with the company to use it with the right, you know, you fill out the right forms, you could basically do anything. And it was a big company. They had plenty of forms.
Right.
And so I have met people who said, oh, we use the trails and we help maintain them, you know, when the company was still there. And when it moved over to becoming a forest, and that's a whole nother story, how that happened, they continued to maintain the trails. And now, if you go to DuPont, there is a horse barn, and the equestrians, the group there, can stay in the barn overnight if they're working like a weekend to maintain the trails.
Oh, nice. I didn't know there was a barn there. I do know that there's an airfield. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yes, I can, because that's, to me, part of the fascination of the whole forest. Adjacent to the company was a summer camp called Summit Camps, which had nothing to do with DuPont. It was a guy who bought the land, and he created a summer camp. You know, Western North Carolina is full of summer camps.
Oh, yeah.
And this was a private concern. And he built a camp for boys, a camp for girls, appropriately separated. And in 1960, he came in about 1966, 67, and he built the lake, Lake Julia. And, you know, what's a camp without a lake, right?
Well, right. You got to keep the girls on one side, boys on the other, and then you get in your canoe late at night.
So,
yeah.
You got a great imagination, Roger. You're probably right, by the way.
Hey, I went to summer camp. I know.
Right, exactly. So I've been a camper and a counselor. And actually, and that's also a whole constituency which I interviewed, were the people, the campers, who are obviously now in their 50s, 60s plus, who thought that the summer camps were the absolute best time of their lives. So the owner built a summer camp, and he was, I think of him as a serial entrepreneur. His name was Ben Cart. And okay. there is actually a Cart trail in the forest. His name was Ben Cart, and he was kind of a serial entrepreneur. And in the 60s, that was his business. And he liked to fly, and he went to a lot of camp conventions. And so he had an airstrip built for him, and also for parents who might drop their kids off by plane. You know, we're talking small private planes here.
Right.
And then he had some leftover land, so to speak, and he envisioned a housing estate, upmarket housing estate. And that's why he built Fawn Lake. You do know about Fawn Lake at the south part of DuPont. It's a small lake. There's a Fawn Lake entrance. And he was going to build what he called the Buck Forest Development. Well, that never happened. He got tired of it. He moved on to something else. But the lake is there. And if you go into the Fawn Lake entrance, you will see some really fancy stonework, because that's where the development was going to be.
Right.
But in 1984 or so, 85, he decided he had it with all of this. And he sold the land to DuPont. And DuPont was very concerned about who their neighbors were going to be. And, you know, they wanted, even though it wasn't as important to have the clean air and clean water then as it was when they first built silicon, it was still very important. There's a lot of water,
right,
that is part of the manufacturing of film. So they knew Ben Cart. They had a good relationship with him. They didn't know who else he was going to sell it to. So they bought the land. So that's how we get an airstrip. And that's how we got Lake Julia and Fawn Lake.
Yeah, because lakes here in the mountains aren't natural.
Exactly.
There weren't any glaciers. Because I come from Northeast Ohio originally. And I used to live on Lake Erie. And that was gouged out by the glaciers.
Exactly. So every lake you see has been built for some purpose. I mean, in the South, has been built for some purpose. And so two lakes were built by Ben Cart, and the other three lakes were built by DuPont, mostly for recreation, because they entertained a lot of salespeople, you know, like the people in the hospitals, they make decisions on film. So they would entertain them, they would bring them fishing. And so they built the other three lakes. Lake Dense, Lake Imaging, and Lake Alfred.
And again, our guest today is Danny Bernstein, an avid hiker of Western North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, I'm sure, and also the author of the book, DuPont Forest, A History, which you can find on Amazon.com. And we're going to chat with her more next.
Explore with RWD. We'll be right back after this.
The dream of home ownership in the early 1900s for most African Americans was a pipe dream. Except in one timber town in Western North Carolina, Corey Valancourt.
You know, the American dream is about ownership. It's about being able to control your own destiny, whether that's the house you live in or the land that you farm. And what Oates told me was both of his grandfathers they had kind of a leg up on other African Americans and on some poor whites, where they had learned to trade. They had been able to save money. And so when his grandparents returned to the towns here of Western North Carolina, Waynesville and Canton, they bought property.
Hear that complete story from Smoky Mountain News staff writer Corey Valancourt in Episode 6 of Explore with RWD.
That wasn't too bad now, was it? Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
Thank you for hanging out throughout the commercial break. I do appreciate you. Again, I'm Roger W. Downs, your host. And our guest today is Danny Bernstein, an avid hiker of Western North Carolina and also author of the book, DuPont Forest, A History. And Danny, we've been talking a little bit about the DuPont Company, who really set up the works for the DuPont Forest to become what it is today. But they were also an amazing company to work for, as you were telling us. First off, they allow you to hunt the property, they let you fish the property, they let you camp on the property, and they had a built-in babysitting service.
Yeah, and you know, and they claim we worked very hard, but we played hard. It was basically, it was an all-inclusive life. And though I personally never worked for DuPont, both my late husband and I did work for large companies up in New Jersey, where they wanted you, they want to encourage you to build your whole life around the company. You know, they loved company marriages, and so they had a lot of recreation, because let's face it, if you're together, you're going to talk business, and that can only help, right?
Right.
Either business or technical stuff. And so, you know, here, in Brevard, where there wasn't as much entertainment as there was in the Northeast, I could see, and many of these people came from the Northeast, where there were plenty of, you know, movies and theater, etc. So I could see where that was in their best interest. But I think DuPont did this for all over the world. I don't think that Brevard was singled out as, you know, being that great a place to work. I think it was the whole company atmosphere.
Well, that sounds like a great company atmosphere, because I worked for corporate America and they didn't treat me anywhere close to that. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other industries, at least the very beginning of industry that came into the DuPont State Forest, because there was the Antler Inn, which is in your book. And there was other people who were looking for ways to monetize to give people, if you will, the mountain lifestyle if you're coming up out of the flats of South Carolina.
Well, I think you're referring to a development that was going to be built in what is now known as DuPont Forest. Mm-hmm. So when DuPont sold the land, sold the business to Sterling Diagnostic, Sterling did not want 10,000 acres. So DuPont sold at bargain basement prices, most of the land, 7,500 acres of it, to the state. And most people say they essentially gave it away. And so Sterling retained the other 2,500 to keep the arithmetic simple.
Okay.
But when Sterling sold the land to AGFA, AGFA didn't want anything except the 450 acres on which the plant stands. So, and that difference between what they wanted and what, and the extra, Sterling sold to a developer. And this was 1999 into 2000. And on that land stood three of the most famous, the best waterfalls in the forest.
Which ones were those?
And that was High Falls, Triple Falls, and Bridal Veil Falls.
Okay.
And people locally were really upset. They were really upset whether they worked for DuPont or not, because they knew what was there. So many people had been to DuPont for one reason or another, even if they didn't live there.
Right.
And So they started petitioning our governor, Governor Hunt at the time, and to do something about it. You've heard of the Cliffs development, right, around here?
Oh, yeah. Everybody, yeah, well, somebody lives there, right?
Right. Well, that was going to be another cliff. It was going to be the Cliffs in Brevard.
Okay.
And they were going to come up with these convoluted arrangements where, yeah, the public could come and just look at the waterfalls from 9 to 5. And but the rest of it, you know, on a very narrow path. So they started negotiating, and finally, and I tell this story blow by blow in the book, finally Governor Hunt just said, let's take the land, and they took it by eminent domain.
I bet you the developer wasn't happy.
Well, he did very well, thank you, because when you take land by eminent domain, that doesn't mean you're giving it away.
Well, no, I know that.
And but. So he bought the land for $6 million, and he got $24 million.
Oh, well, yeah, he wasn't hating life.
And he, you know, his big claim was that he had made all of these improvements. Now, the improvement that he made, I mean, he did do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the improvement that is the biggest, in my view, is this is when the covered bridge came along. He built the covered bridge over the top of High Falls. And he also widened several roads. Because after all, this was going to be a development. People weren't going to hike. They were going to walk. They were going to drive. I'm sorry. They were going to drive.
Right.
So he made a few improvements, you know, in my book, not the difference between $6 million and $24 million, but that's what he got. And now the state had almost an intact forest. So they had the original 7,500 acres. They had the about 2,200 acres for 2,200 acres that they just got. And AGFA was still there, actually, in the plant, you know, still manufacturing.
Right.
And so when AGFA closed down, and this to me is extremely important.
Okay.
DuPont Corporation retained the rights of cleanup. And now some people say, what do you mean rights? You mean obligation. Call it what you want. They did not want another company to clean up. They were going to do it. So AGFA took down the buildings, and you know, every single brick seems to have been looked over. It took several years until they took down all the buildings in an environmentally safe way. And then DuPont came back to start cleaning the water. And they're still there. They are still here.
They've been really good neighbors to the forest and the people of Western North Carolina, haven't they?
They've been good neighbors. They are doing everything by the book. There is still one guy who we call the last man standing who works for DuPont, and he is the one that manages all the contractors who come in and out to clean various aspects, you know, and he's a record keeper, et cetera. I have been very fortunate throughout this project to get so much cooperation. And I was able to get a trip through what they call the donut hole, because it's a little bit, it's 464 acres or so that of land, which is off limits to visitors in the middle of this huge forest. And so he gave me a tour. And when you go there, it's basically a lot of cracked concrete, because all the buildings are down, but this is where they had all the parking lots.
Right.
And it's also, as he will, his name is Chet, as he will tell you very proudly, where all of the home base for all the movies that have made in DuPont are.
Oh,
the two most, you know, they, the movie companies come in with all of their trailers and everything else. They're not going to be hiking. Mm-mm. So they put all of that in the parking area in the donut hole. And they were, you know, like they're two, to me, the two most famous movies were The Last of the Mohicans, which was filmed when DuPont was still there. And I can picture that they had, you know, part of the parking lot to put all their stuff. But as I say, nobody wants to hear me talk about The Last of the Mohicans. Everybody wants to talk about The Hunger Games.
No, I'd rather hear about Last of the Mohicans, but go ahead and talk about The Hunger Games. I got so lost in The Hunger Games, and I know I shouldn't talk bad about movies, but I'm like, really? Are we done yet? Is this movie over? Can we go home?
Well, you took your kids, right? To see that?
I did. And I'm like, are we out of popcorn yet? Can I just walk out of here, stretch my legs?
Well, I was very lucky. My husband went with the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But when I worked on the book, you can be sure I saw The Hunger Games on streaming on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
And they used a couple of the waterfalls. And they used the airstrip. I describe all of this in my book. They used the airstrip in a very clever way. There is a scene, not that I expect you to remember it, because I only remember it because I keep writing about it. There is a scene when the two main characters are in a on a train and going to whatever the capital of their kingdom is.
Mm-hmm.
And through the magic of CGI, they placed a train on the airstrip, and that's how they filmed that particular scene. Wow. And also there was a lot of running around in the various parts of DuPont.
Right.
And there were other movies. I saw a lot of bad movies, let me tell you, because they were filmed at DuPont.
Right.
Anyway, that's the donut hole.
Okay. I didn't know that I knew that they shot a lot of movies there. I knew The Last of the Mohicans was shot there, and I loved The Last of the Mohicans because I'm a big history buff. I love anything like that.
Right.
The Hunger Games, my kids liked, and I've seen those movies more times than I ever wanted to. Because like, hey, let's watch Hunger Games again. I'm like, oh yes, please, let's do that. But I after watching The Hunger Games and getting down to the DuPont State Forest, I'm like, oh, that's Triple Falls. I know exactly where that's at.
Right,
I've been there.
Right, exactly.
Right. So that's kind of interesting to see those locations in fantasy or in a historical piece. Because they used Triple Falls in The Last of the Mohicans as well, where they were walking through up through a waterfall, and that was Triple Falls. So I'm like, I know exactly where that's at.
And they also used Bridal Veil Falls in The Last of the Mohicans. That movie was shot completely in Western North Carolina. And if you really watch it, because I don't know how many times I've seen that movie, you can see them jumping from one area to the next. Like in one scene, they are in a DuPont and they flow right into Chimney Rock State Park.
Right.
And I'm saying, wait a minute, that's about 30 miles or so, if not longer, away. So they filmed at every place in Western North Carolina without worrying about geography.
Oh, yeah, because I noticed that, too, in The Last of the Mohicans when they're on the trail and they throw and the girl jumps off the cliff. I'm like,
yeah, that's Chimney Rock.
I'm like, that's Chimney Rock. I've been on that trail.
Exactly.
So when I took my son out there, I'm like, this is where she jumped. See if you can see her body. And he's like, what? But it's a fascinating book that you have, by the way. Again, chatting with Danny Bernstein, the author of DuPont Forest, A History. And I love the stories in it because they're real. They're accounts of what people lived, opposed to a fantasy like The Hunger Games, or even probably some of the variations in The Last of the Mohicans, because I'm sure they took a lot of that and just twisted around any way they wanted.
Oh, sure.
But your book is absolutely fantastic, Danny. I love it so far. I've gotten through about a fourth of it, and I would encourage people who love the forest, especially DuPont, to pick it up at Amazon.com. Where else is it sold, by the way?
Well, it's sold at Malaprops in Asheville. Mm-hmm. It's sold at Highland Books in Brevard, and Brevard is kind of the epicenter of DuPont. It's the closest town. But I am amazed at other places where it's sold. You know, it's in REI is getting it, and because it's both an outdoor book and a history book. It's not a hiking book, though I do describe a few hikes that I've done. I've hiked all the trails in DuPont as part of doing this.
Right.
And so I do describe a few, but it's a narrative. It is not a turn-by-turn hiking guide. I have written two turn-by-turn hiking guides of Western North Carolina, but this is not. DuPont is not.
Well, no, it's a fascinating history book. And the reason I love it is because when I go out into the forest, when I first moved here in 2013, I was following a radio gig. I worked for 99.9 Kiss Country.
Oh.
But I fell in love with the forest and the mountains. And that's a whole other long story, which it boils down to this. When I was in marching band in high school, I fell in love with the Smoky Mountains because we came down for a band competition when I was like 17 years old. And I thought, man, I got to get back here someday. I'd love to live there. And when they said, hey, there's a job opening at Kiss Country, I'm like, please hire me, please. But what really has always intrigued me is when I'm walking through the forest and you see like an old chimney or you see an old barn as you pull into one of the state forests and you think, I wonder what the story is behind that structure. What is the story behind this forest? What is the story behind this path or trail? You know? And those are the things that have always fascinated me because I'm like, who has come before me and laid the groundwork so I can enjoy this forest? And also, what has happened here prior to my life on this planet?
Right, right. And our parks and our forests tell a lot of stories. Now, there is a major difference between parks and forests that people need to appreciate. Parks like Great Smoky Mountains National Park, like the state parks, like Mount Mitchell State Park, are created for recreation and preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So they are much more likely to preserve that barn. Because, you know, if you just leave a barn out all these years, it's just going to fall apart.
Right.
But a forest, both state or national, has got other priorities, and preservation is not one of them. If they can't use something, they'll have to take it down. So, for example, when I first came here and started hiking, there was a huge, beautiful building right opposite Lake Julian. I have a picture of it in my book. Boy, am I lucky I took those pictures way before I thought of writing a book.
Right.
And this was just after the condemnation. So literally, I could picture the contractor saying, okay, guys, we lost. just drop your tools. We're out of here. And it was a beautiful building. It had been the girls' dining room for the summit camps. And it's gone now. It was falling apart. The state forest did not have funds to use it. You know, it wasn't going to be just an artifact if there was no fund to use it. And it was falling apart. It was probably a hazard. And they took it down. If you go to Lake Julia, on the other side, there is another building with a history that I write about from summit camps. But there, they're able to use the building. So they're maintaining it.
Oh, well, that makes sense. And I didn't know that was the difference between parks and forests. I'm glad you shared that because I didn't know that. That was part of,
right,
if you will, their purpose.
Their mission, absolutely. Yeah, their mission. And that's why, even though DuPont is a recreational forest, very important words, DuPont State Recreational Forest, there is some hunting and there is some logging. And people are shocked until I mention, hey, this is a forest, not a park. You can't hunt in parks, but you can hunt in forests. Now, it's not like Pisgah. They don't have, it's very tightly controlled. The hunting, I mean.
Yeah.
But there is hunting.
So let me ask you this before I wrap things up. What is your favorite trail and what is your favorite waterfall and why in DuPont?
Wow. Roger, how many children do you have?
Six.
God bless you. Do you think that somebody could ask you what is your favorite child and you would answer?
Yeah, I'd say Zach. No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. I'm kidding. No.
Seriously, my favorite trail is the one I'm on now, and I do a lot of hiking outside of DuPont. Or the one that I'm going to next. As far as the favorite waterfall, you know, I love them all. Mm-hmm. But if you really pin me down, I love Wintergreen. Wintergreen is just a little tucked away. It's not a secret, okay? It's on every map.
Okay.
But it's just a little tucked away. The shortest way of getting there is from Guyon Farms. And you have to sort of scramble up, not on the waterfall. You're scrambling on dry rock to see the waterfall.
Okay.
And it's much smaller, and it's really cute, if you can use the word cute for a waterfall. But they're all extremely impressive. You know, this whole area in Transylvania County specifically is the land of the waterfalls.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right.
Wow. I have to say that I really love Hooker Falls.
Yes.
For me, it's just because you can go down there, and I go down early in the morning. Like, I'll get there at 6 o'clock in the morning before the sun comes up. It's usually me and some other photographer. There isn't, or right. Somebody who might be fishing, maybe. But I'll go down, and I'll just kind of sit there and just kind of zone in to the forest and all the artistry that's before me. And I really just love Hooker Falls. I don't know what it is about it. I can't put my finger on it. I just know when I go there, I just feel really content.
I don't know when the last time you were there, but the Forest Service has rerouted the trail to Hooker Falls. It's a tiny bit longer, not much, but it's very smooth now. So you might be interested in going back just to see that what they did with it.
Well, actually, that's how I got in touch with you because I did take that trail.
Okay.
And what got me to you, and this, it's always like one connection after another, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I was wandering through, and I'm like, there's a graveyard over here. And I'm going to chat with someone coming up very shortly. And forgive me, I can't remember her name right offhand, but her family was the Heaths, who are buried in that graveyard. And it's a very sad story, and I'm sure you probably know it. I believe it was one son and three daughters who died of diphtheria.
Diphtheria, yes. Her name is Patty Stalls.
Mm-hmm. That's her, Patty, yes.
The woman you're referring to.
Yes.
And she can trace her family back to Isaac Heath. And she married a DuPont engineer. But she still lives in Cedar Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And periodically she gives tours of what life was like before DuPont, you know, from her family history.
Yeah, and she talks about an inn, and there's going to be, I'll have her on a podcast as well. And I know she's going to talk about an inn that was there and and a mill.
Right.
And all sorts of fascinating things. I go, really? And she's like, oh, yeah. She goes, the foundations are still in some of those spots. I'm thinking, now I've got to go back and look.
Yeah, there was a hotel before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called Buck Forest Hotel, not to be confused with Buck Forest Lodge,
right,
which is much more modern. There was a hotel there. It was a commercial hotel. And after the Civil War, it kind of fell apart. The owners were still there and, you know, passed down to another generation. And it kind of fell apart by the early 1900s. where people were no longer traveling by stagecoach.
Right.
And I have a picture of the Buck Forest Hotel that I got from the Transylvania County Library. They were wonderful with all the pictures that are historical pictures that I use. So I'm glad that you're getting Patty Stahl.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to hear her stories as well. And speaking about your book again, let's make sure, and I would like to take an opportunity to allow you to thank anyone that you would like who helped you to put that book together. So,
because how much time do we have here, Roger? Now, seriously, I cannot thank all of the people that I interviewed, talked to, and, you know, both the former employees, the folks who were there before it became DuPont, all of the state legislators that I talked to, and the activists that helped to save the waterfalls.
Mm-hmm.
And I acknowledge them all. And even people like the bikers and the equestrians who helped me understand the forest from a different point of view. And of course, the Transylvania County Library, their North Carolina room, there wasn't much there, but what was there was invaluable. And so I want to thank everybody for helping me write this book. They all contributed something.
Well, awesome. And again, I'm going to put a link to be able to purchase this book in the description of this podcast. So wherever you're listening to it, be it on Pandora, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, you'll be able to find in the description a link to Amazon to purchase DuPont Forest, A History by Danny Bernstein, who is our guest. And Danny, thank you again so much for your time and sharing the history of the DuPont State Forest and how it came to be. And even now that there's a gigantic parking lot out there for movie sets, but I just, all of that is fascinating. It really is. And I now I have more to go look at and go discover in the forest.
Well, thank you so much, Roger, for having me. This was a blast. I love to talk about DuPont and about forests in general.
Perfect. Oh, one last thing. You said you wrote two other books about trails and turn by turns. What are the names of those books?
Okay. I have written four other books. The two turn by turn books are called Hiking the Carolina Mountains,
mm-hmm,
and Hiking the North Carolina Blue Ridge. And they're obviously also available at Malaprops and online. And I do a lot of hiking, and I hiked all the mountains to see. So I wrote a book on the Mountains to Sea Trail across North Carolina.
Nice.
It is nice. And I wrote a book on the national parks in the South called Forest, Alligators, Battlefields.
Forest, Alligators, and Battlefields.
And that's pretty much the national park units in the southern region.
Well, I'm going to have to pick up those books.
You sure do. They're all online as well. So thank you so much.
Okay, Danny, thank you again. And may you have happy holidays, of course.
And you too. Bye-bye. Bye.
Explore with RWD. We'll be right back after this.
Those are the melodies of Native American Matthew Tunai, who not only is a cultural storyteller for the Cherokee Nation in Cherokee, North Carolina, but also an accomplished and award-winning musician and Baptist minister. So how does Matthew weave his culture, his religion, and talents all together? Well, that is a story you have to hear for yourself in Episode 4 of Explore with RWD. Or read about it now at explorewithrwd.com.
Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
Now, before we wrap up this episode of Explore with RWD, I want to personally thank you for for listening to this podcast. Maybe you've been listening right along, and thank you so much for doing that on whatever platform you found us. Maybe you're listening through Anchor.fm or Pandora or iHeartRadio or even Spotify. And if this is your first time listening, I want to thank you as well for taking a chance on this podcast, and hopefully it was informational for you. And I hope you'll continue to listen by subscribing on whatever platform you may be listening on. You can also read some of our other blogs, listen to our other podcasts, and see some of our other photos at explorewithrwd.com. And if there's a place you think I should go explore or someone I should talk to or interview, please send an email to Roger, R-O-G-E-R, at explorewithrwd.com. Again, I want to thank our guest today, Dani Bernstein, for her time. She's an avid hiker of Western North Carolina and also the author of the book, DuPont Forest, A History. Please swing by Amazon.com and pick up your copy, and make sure you leave her a review as well. She really loves your feedback and would love to hear what you think about her book and the stories within it. Finally, if no one else has told you this yet today, I love you, and I know the good Lord above loves you. He has promised you that, so make sure to count your blessings, because life truly is good. And no matter what you've done, no matter what your sin is, all you have to do is ask for forgiveness, and he'll separate you from your sin like the east from the west. So until next time, peace, love, and coon dogs, y'all.
Thank you for listening. Visit us online at explorewithrwd.com to discover more about Roger, his photography, podcast, and adventures. Or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at explorewithrwd. Remember, we didn't inherit the earth from our parents. We borrow it from our children. May God bless you and yours. Now get outside and go explore. Explore with RWD is produced by Downs Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.